All right, everybody, it is time for another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. But before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy to understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, all of you good citizens of Crypt Nation, time to wake up. It is that time of the day. It is Crypto 101 Podcast. We are here. We're in the studio. I'm with my trusted compadre and my BFF, Mr. Aaron Pizza Mind Malone. Aaron, what's cooking in your side of the kitchen, man?
You know, I've really been trying to look for some new tools to try and find the next best thing. And as I've mentioned on several episodes before, I'm really tired of my phone and my computer spying on me and sending me ads for things that I literally only thought about and never even said out loud to my cat Clyde.
They're in our brains.
They're in our brains. I need some kind of reprieve. So I'm looking for something else out there that is less intrusive, more respectful to privacy, and, you know, just, this can't go on forever. It's got to hit, you know, maximum thrust at some point and come crashing back to Earth, right?
Well, Pete, I got great news for you, brother. It's not over, and there is hope. And we have solutions that the blockchain and the crypto industry have put together to preserve your privacy, to preserve your sovereignty as an individual, and to give you the tools to make, you know, better, more informed decisions and more options. And this is increasingly relevant day after day, because there is currently a big lawsuit, an antitrust, for those of you guys who don't know, basically means anti-monopoly. So when a company has too much control over an industry, the regulators step in and say, hey, we're going to call a monopoly on you guys, and we're going to have to go through and try and break this whole thing up in order to get fair, more competitive pricing and a free market and all that kind of stuff. So Google is on the chopping block of the regulators right now because of some very interesting monopolistic implications. And we got an expert who's building a competitor to Google as we speak, and we're going to dive into that. So Colin Pape from Presearch, founder of Presearch, welcome to Crypto 101 Podcast.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Bryce and Aaron. Great to be here.
Yeah, man, we're excited. Typically we dive into the background of our guest immediately, but this is so timely because it's in the news right now. We're going to dive straight into the Google monopoly lawsuit. What's going on? High level, for those of guys who you know, like us, we're not lawyers. We don't really know what's going on. So break down a little bit about that, and then we'll dive into, after that, kind of your background.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, it's pretty amazing timing because within the past couple of hours, the U.S. Department of Justice has filed this lawsuit that you've mentioned, this is something that's been in the works for a long time. We originally participated in an FTC investigation back in 2011, 2012 through our other company, ShopCity.com. And so this is kind of the latest iteration. At the time, back, 8 years ago, Google really had a massive monopoly on search, but it was really the first time that they had been called out on it. And so they had some defenses. And then since then, a number of other governments, particularly the EU, has, sanctioned Google with, significant multi-billion dollar fines. Basically, the contention is that, with more than 90% market share, the number one web browser with Google Chrome, the number one mobile operating system with Android, number one video platform with YouTube, number one mapping platform with Google Maps, and number one email platform with Gmail, this company just has, a stranglehold basically on the internet. They control how we find information and access it. And they've basically been using all these different relationships and different platforms to reinforce their dominance of the marketplace. And in the process, they have been harming, consumers, as well as obviously, businesses and competitors. But this is really kind of the second go around. And they've got, I would say, more evidence. They've got more resolve. And because they did nothing, essentially, it was basically nothing, a minor slap on the wrist 8 or so years ago. And they're back at it again. They basically have to do something. And it's really, in this super polarized political environment, this is one of the only really kind of bipartisan issues where both sides are coming and saying this needs to happen. There's too much power and control in the hands of one entity, and so they filed this lawsuit. They're going to be looking for more information on some of the practices that they employ to ensure market dominance, both on the consumer usage side as well as on the advertising platform side. And so it's kind of an interesting time to be, starting a competitor to Google, where you've kind of got these tailwinds and these interesting media opportunities to speak about an alternative that is, more about user choice, more about user privacy, which are really, two of the big things that are kind of going against Google in this case. So yeah, it's an interesting time. And over the next 6 months, we're going to see how that plays out. We are not directly involved in the legal action this time, but we're very familiar with the players. And this is kind of a bit of a different, opportunity with the business that we're in now compared to the one that we were in last time, where we were basically, being directly harmed by Google, and our company ShopCity.com had experienced this penalty that had basically put all of our search results on, page 5, page 8 of Google, and basically buried us, and kind of gave us this interesting control group type scenario that was very interesting to the regulators. And I should just say, I'm not really a fan of, additional, government legal action, and, certainly preferring the free market, which is, what we're doing. We're trying to provide a free market alternative to the, regulatory action. But, a lot of people who are, minarchists, which would be, people who believe in as little government regulation as possible. Even some of those people believe that one of the legitimate functions of government should be to, ensure that monopolistic entities do not end up, completely dominating a market and holding everybody hostage. So it is kind of this, you know, interesting scenario that Google's in.
Well, I'll tell you this much. No matter what the regulator decides, I am not going back to Internet Explorer and Bing. You can forget it. So, Colin, can you give us a better alternative once Google's finally shattered into however many pieces? What else is out there?
Yeah, definitely. So basically, the way pre-search works, and so just to be clear, we're focusing on search right now. You know, we think that is really the most centralized and influential tentacle that Google has. You know, the other ones are all certainly important as well, but search is kind of this gateway to information on the internet. It's something as well, you know, with the way that Google was founded as basically an educational project, you know, from their time at Stanford University and with their positioning with, you know, kind of the silly childish name and the, you know, multicolored logo. They really kind of put people's guard down, and they you know, achieved adoption in the early days by really having this strong brand of being, you know, impartial and being, you know, more kind of educational in nature. And, you know, in the 20 years since then, you know, obviously that's not been the case, proven time and time again. They're one of the most competitive businesses that's ever existed. And they will do anything that they can to dominate the markets that they're in. But, you know, there's kind of still this you know, perception that a lot of people have that Google is neutral, that Google is just, you know, building
quote unquote,
great products.
Don't be evil, right? That's their tagline.
That's right. Which they actually they changed, and that went away a number of years ago because they realized that they couldn't even say that in good conscience anymore. So
it was one of those things I saw. I forget who it was, but somebody tweeted out of like, can you believe that a company, you know, their tagline is don't be evil. It just goes to show how much power that they really do have, that they could be evil. Why wouldn't a better slogan for, like, you know, like pre-search, for instance, can't be evil, like physically can't be evil because you have better aligned incentives.
Yeah, it totally, man.
But it always feels so funny, just like, I mean, this is not even a question. I'll let you continue your thought, but it's just more of it's just a comment. But like the end game of capitalism tends to be these monopolies, right? You're always incentivized to be the best, to be the most competitive. From when you're a very young kid, right? You want to be the best on your team. You want to get the best grades. You go, you start your business. You want to dominate the competition and all that stuff. And then you get there and you're like, oh my God, did we go too far? Did we fly too close to the sun? And then you have to get reined back in. But I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's you know, it's a different approach than we're taking, and I think than what drives us. You know, for me personally, it's, you know, it's just not in my DNA. Honestly, I've always been, you know, someone to root for the underdog, and I mean, we're from. Right now, our office that we're sitting in is in, you know, it's a little town in Canada, population 17,500. I've spent enough time on Silicon Valley, and it's, you know, it's got some, you know, interesting aspects to it. But, you know, we identify a lot more with, you know, middle America, middle Canada, you know, more kind of average people. And I think, you know, we're really more about community, essentially, and trying to, you know, bring people together and help others realize their potential rather than just, you know, kind of trying to mow everybody's lawn and dominate everybody. I mean, you hear the early conversations with, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, for instance, and some of his co-founders. It's like, you know, they had this attitude where they just wanted to squash everybody. And for us, it's about like recognizing there's so many other players that are out there that have value. And, you know, how can we create an ecosystem that enables those people to participate as well and ultimately you know, gives the user, the person who's utilizing the service, the choice, so that it's not forced upon them. And so to answer Aaron's question, like, how are we going to tackle this, you know, differently? So basically, Presearch, we founded in 2017. It was kind of born, you know, a lot from this experience that we have with ShopCity and Google, which just, you know, to us just seemed like totally, you know, backwards, and it just didn't seem right. Honestly, we were, you know, doing things exactly like what Google had said they wanted. You know, we weren't focused on search engine optimization, where we were trying to like game the system to get traffic that we didn't deserve. We had, you know, super high quality content, partnerships with city governments and all these different local stakeholders to try to basically build all these marketplaces, almost like an Amazon.com for each community, powered by its local businesses. And all of a sudden, you know, Google basically shuts us down. There's nobody that we can communicate with. We're basically just getting stonewalled everywhere we turn. And it just, you know, felt really wrong. And then in the process of going through this, we discover that there are like tens of thousands of other, you know, businesses and projects that had encountered the same thing and basically ended up, you know, either going under or having to do, you know, huge restructuring just to try to stay afloat while Google kind of sucked the wind out of their sails. And so, you know, when we started realizing that Ethereum was going to be this, you know, platform where we could create a token that would enable us to align the interests of our searchers on the one side and then our sponsors or advertisers on the other side, we just realized that it was, you know, a way that we could go to market and basically incentivize people to switch from Google, which, I mean, Google has probably the strongest brand allegiance and also, you know, user behavior that, you know, they've trained people on over the past 20 years, and plus all these other moats. And, you know, one of the biggest moats that they have is, you know, being the default search engine in all these web browsers. So they're the default in Chrome, the default in Safari. They pay Apple like $10 billion a year, literally, to the default search engine in Safari. Like, it's insane. Wow. Right. And so how do you compete with that? Well, we thought, well, you know, if we can come out with a search engine that is more focused on user privacy, more focused on user choice, because it's not actually just a single search engine. Through Presearch, you can search Google, you can search DuckDuckGo, you can search Etherscan if you're into crypto, you can search, you know, there's over 100 different resources, and we're adding new ones all the time. So it was about.
I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So if you run a search on Presearch, then you'll see down the left-hand side underneath the Presearch logo, you know, a handful of different logos, and you can actually go in and you can choose which ones you want. So, like, I always search Etherscan. I'm looking up addresses and stuff. So I basically have it. So it's like, you know, one click search into directly to Etherscan. We're not like aggregating everybody's results and trying to, you know, be the one interface that rules them all. We're basically respecting everybody's UIs. We're just making it super easy for the searcher to direct their query to any of the different resources that they might utilize. And so, you know, that's how we kind of facilitate choice. And then, you know, we wanted to reward the people who were basically making the effort to, you know, use something that, you know, might not be as polished as Google yet, or that might, you know, not be as integrated because we don't have all these, you know, partnerships with web browsers and whatnot. And so basically, whenever you search, you earn a quarter of a Presearch token. And then that token has value because it is the payment mechanism for the advertising platform. And we ended up creating a kind of a novel way of controlling the advertising. It's something called keyword staking. And so basically, whoever stakes the most Presearch tokens to a given term will have their ad displayed. And there's currently actually no consumptive charge for it. So you don't pay when you get clicks. You don't pay when you get views. As long as you have the most tokens allocated to that term, then your ad shows up. And so it kind of, you know, completes both sides of the ecosystem and does it in a way where we're not, you know, doing what Google does, which is, you know, track everybody like you guys were talking about. You know, sometimes it feels like, man, did I just think that and somehow they found out and now they're sending me ads? It's like, you know, our stuff is much more about active personalization. So, you know, you tell us how we can make it a better user experience for you. We're not going to try to infer all of these things off of your behavior and compromise your privacy in the process. So, you know, it's a totally different take, but we've kind of got a new version that we're getting ready to roll out before the end of the year. That uses pre-search nodes. So basically anybody will be able to install a node on their computer or on excess data center capacity. When somebody does a search through pre-search, it goes into like a gateway system and then it has all these nodes that are in there kind of pooled up and ready and waiting for queries. And then the query gets sent out to the node and then the node basically goes out and fetches the results from a bunch of existing search engines and then brings that back in and then reconstructs the user interface. And so that's kind of phase one. And then phase two is actually integrating like blockchain-based search results so that anything where there's, you know, censorship or where results are being totally skewed because of an agenda that, you know, our community members can basically start contributing different search results and then voting on them to determine where they are ranked within kind of all these other results that are basically being aggregated from existing sources. So we're pretty pumped about that release and everything that that we've done over the past 3 years. It's been awesome and all really centered around our community and empowering people like you guys who care about this stuff and don't want to be tracked and don't want to participate as, you know, a cog in the wheel and want, you know, an alternative that ultimately is going to be, you know, open sourced and, you know, fully community driven and something that, you know, you can inspect deeply to ensure that, you know, it is doing what it says it does and it's not, you know, tracking you or databasing your queries or any of these kinds of things.
Wow. Colin, you literally just answered just about every single question I had in the outline. So you did my job for me, brother. But you touched on the role of the pre-search token. You talked about how people could earn it, right? Just by going to pre-search.org and start, you know, typing in your searches through the pre-search interface instead of just going directly through Google. So guys, if you're listening, wake up, right? You guys could be earning money for every search that you guys put out. You even talked about that model of, you know, advertisers can stake keywords. It's non-consumptive. So you really hit all the key points there about like kind of how the system works. So thank you for that. And one of the questions that kind of came to mind that we didn't put in the outline, but if I'm using pre-search.org and I make a search query through Google, do I compromise my privacy and my identity in doing that by going, even though I'm going through pre-search, or is it kind of like some type of VPN that gets filtered in there? How does that all work?
So basically, when you use an external resource, like we're literally kicking you over to, you know, google.com, google.ca, we're not acting as a proxy service. And so, you know, as you get out to that external resource, yes, you are still, you know, vulnerable. But basically what we're doing with this new node-based user experience is, you know, protecting you and providing you with Google quality results. So literally the new version is as good or better than Google. It has all the bells and whistles. It has the same, you know, high quality search results. But, you know, in key instances where, you know, there's censorship happening or other, you know, weirdness happening with results, the community will be able to override that and help to basically shape the actual search results. So it will ultimately have our own index involved, but to start, It's largely powered by, you know, there's a handful of existing search engines and other APIs and resources that we're calling on. But yeah, unfortunately, there's kind of only so much we can do without being a full proxy service. And we basically just kind of made the decision right now that, you know, that's actually a huge point of centralization. And a lot of people don't really realize it. There's a lot of trust that you're putting into a VPN when you are running all your stuff through them. And sometimes, you know, it's risky, actually. So, I mean, we just didn't feel that was the right move right now. Might ultimately be something. There's some decentralized VPN and routing services that are coming to market, and those might be, you know, really interesting. But right now, almost all the VPN services, I mean, if you're not using, like, you know, torrents and stuff, they're fairly centralized. So, yeah, basically, it's still kind of be cautious. I mean, DuckDuckGo is an interesting alternative as well, although it is basically just powered by Bing. And Aaron said he no freaking way is going back to Internet Explorer and Bing. So
that's right.
If you don't like Bing, I mean, DuckDuckGo is actually just kind of a layer on Bing. So, but yeah, it's about, for us, you know, more providing easy, you know, one click access to all the different resources. If you feel like you've got a super private query you don't want anybody to know about, maybe you want to send it to, you know, our new engine when it's released, or DuckDuckGo, if it's something, you know, that you're less concerned about and you want, you know, Google UI, then, you know, feed it out to Google.
You know, as I'm listening to all this and I'm seeing the page and even in the name pre-search, what happens before you go to search something? Bryce, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but we used to open up our web browsers to a home page. Some of us that are my age and Colin's age, you know, we'd open up the web browser, we'd be taken immediately to MSN.com or Yahoo or whatever it was, and that was our portal to everything else. We could just click through. We didn't have to type in, you know, all these web addresses, or, you know, if there were bookmarks. We had all these things right through this portal. And it sounds like that's what pre-search is it's bringing back the home page. Right now, like, I can't stand anything else that exists out there. I just open a new tab and go directly to where I want, because I don't want to be shown a bunch of content that I don't want. I don't want to be bombarded by the latest story about the Kardashians. I remember I was on Yahoo for forever as my home page, and you used to be able to customize your news feed, so I'd only get the topics I wanted. And then they took that away so they could just destroy my mind with all this useless garbage. And I thought, oh my God, this is an assault. I can't use Yahoo anymore. I've used it for 15 years and now it's gone. And I haven't had anything in that new tab since. But it sounds like pre-search is incorporating everything I want. I mean, if I can go straight to Etherscan, that's probably my second most used website at this point. So that's phenomenal that you guys are bringing back the homepage. And I love the ad model of just being able to stake a keyword. I think we should go pick up some pre-search tokens and stake Ripple and Tron so Crypto 101 podcast comes up.
Totally, man. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the internet did used to, you know, feel like a little bit, you know, less controlled. And interestingly, so one of the, you know, actually, it was 2005, I think I started it. And you can look it up on archive.org. But it was a homepage builder. It was called Startster.com. Friendster was a big thing back then. And so you could basically go in, you could configure all your different resources and had a bunch of different search fields. And, you know, we would provide some different content. It was all, like, you know, freedom oriented stuff and kind of alternative stuff. I went back onto it actually a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, oh man, there's some really good stuff on here that's, like, super relevant, you know, 15 years later. But yeah, you know, there used to be this ability. And so as we were actually rolling that out, we had, like, a pretty decent go-to-market strategy. It was working. And then Google rolled out something called iGoogle, which was their homepage builder, where you could basically go and configure all these different resources And it was actually one of my big business lessons in life, just, you know, getting scared by these huge competitors that have all these resources and users. And I ended up shutting it down prematurely because I just thought, oh, there's no way I can compete with Google. And sure enough, you know, a few years later, it went big. It ended up displacing a number of other homepage builders. And then, you know, a few years later, they ended up just shutting it down and completely discontinued the service, and made me realize that, you know, you've got to stick with things, even in the face of, you know, massive competitors, because they just don't have the same ability to focus on a niche, you know, opportunity. And they're just not as driven and committed as an entrepreneur or a community would be. And so that, you know, is part of what gives us the resolve to stand up to Google and to, you know, challenge them and to call them out on some of the things that they're doing that a lot of people disagree with. But yeah, totally agree. I mean, there's an interesting place for a homepage still, specifically if you're on a desktop or a laptop. And it's a way just to, you know, streamline your workflow, specifically for power users and web workers who are doing things, you know, repetitively, rather than, you know, pull up Etherscan and then, you know, find their search field and type in there. You can basically do it right off your homepage, click the Etherscan logo, and then you've got the results. So
it's really an impressive platform, and just as impressive actually as the technology is some of the adoption in the numbers that you guys are putting up. When I was going through the white paper, I saw some, you know, pretty impressive usage statistics. So could you walk us through some highlights, maybe some milestones that that you're really proud of you and your team for having achieved?
Yeah, totally. So we're at more than 1.6 million registered users. We've got, you know, it kind of depends on the month, but, you know, in the high single digit millions up to 10 million searches per month that run through it. We ended up getting some like insane growth right off the bat. We launched a referral program, so, and it still exists. But it really took off. I mean, it's been what's been driving our growth for the past year and a half or 2 years since we launched it. You earn 25 pre-search tokens when somebody joins through your referral link. And so, you know, we basically wanted to build out, we were hoping to get to like 100,000 users within 12 months so that we would have enough data to test with. We had to, you know, build like an anti-abuse system for all the people trying to just, you know, farm tokens and stuff. And we needed some data, and we ended up releasing this thing in May of 2018. And by June, we had 200,000 users, and we were like, oh my gosh, it just like blew up. And so we kind of, you know, put the brakes on it a little bit because we didn't quite have all the token economics, and, you know, we hadn't really closed the loop yet. We didn't have our, you know, this advertising platform that we're using. We had one, but it was like super rudimentary, and there were kind of just, you know, it wasn't the optimal thing. It wasn't related really to the keywords at all. It was basically just, there was a link below the search field on this. So if you set it as your homepage, then, you know, we would have a sponsored link. And so that was what we launched with. And then we kind of realized that, you know, a lot of people actually, I use it as my homepage, and I love the homepage view. But, you know, a lot of people do just want to search through the address bar. So we ended up coming out with a browser extension to make it easier. And then that made that advertising opportunity a little bit, less, valuable. And so we kind of went back to the drawing board. We came out with another, ad model, and we tried that. And it was more based on consumptive charges. So it was charging you like a quarter pre per view on your ad. And we realized that a lot of people didn't want to spend their tokens on advertising because they felt that they were more valuable and they wanted to hold on to them for the future. And so that was what drove us to come up with keyword staking, because, you know, you don't deplete your pre-search token assets. But you can utilize them, you can get traffic. It's still the same thing as far as kind of closing the demand loop. and creating demand for the tokens, which then creates the market so that the people who are earning them have somebody to sell them to. And it's been working really, really well. We've got about 60 some odd million pre-search tokens that are staked currently. There's about 3,500 keywords that are currently being staked.
Is there a dashboard that we could go to check out those sorts of staking statistics?
Some of the stats are more on the back end. Yeah, we are getting ready to release a public page that will have, like, you know, all the different stats for the project in real time. But if you go into keywords.presearch.org, that is the platform where you can create these keyword ads, and you can basically type in any different keyword that you might be interested in, and it will tell you what the maximum stake is for that keyword currently. So you kind of see things that way. There's a few members of our community that have built out like spreadsheets and stuff, and there's kind of a community intelligence, community that's been growing. But in the future, yeah, we will have all those stats available in real time.
Well, I know what I'm doing all afternoon. That's really cool. I want to shift the narrative, though, to something slightly different. We're just coming out of the aftermath of the KuCoin hack, one of the biggest hacks in crypto history, yet probably the only one of this magnitude that ended up not crushing the company entirely. And a big reason to that is an unprecedented response from the rest of the crypto community to pitch in and help KuCoin recover a lot of these funds, whether it was through Tether freezing wallets in their smart contract or tokens like Presearch being willing to do a token swap. Can you walk us through that day when you get notified by KuCoin saying, hey, we just lost millions of pre-tokens. Can you help us out? What goes through your mind? What are the pros and cons that you're weighing of essentially putting a pause on your whole business and going through this huge inconvenience of a token swap?
Yeah, it's been, truthfully, it's been an interesting couple of months. We've been working with KuCoin since April, I guess, of this year. And truthfully, that, like, they've been pretty good to deal with. I mean, they kind of bill themselves as the people's exchange. I mean, they've all got their issues. I mean, the whole space is kind of weird. And, you know, from a regulatory standpoint and everything, it's you know, there's so many gray areas, and it's, you know, there's just weirdness kind of across the board. But in general, like, they've been pretty good to deal with, and they seem like they actually care about the space. And, you know, they ended up, getting compromised, I believe. I mean, it's not official yet, but we believe it was like an internal employee or somebody who had access to the private keys, which, I mean, you can fault them for that. And, you know, they should be faulted for that. But by the same measure, it could happen to a lot of projects and a lot of exchanges. And so, you know, we've tried to kind of not be too hard on them. And when they basically, you know, messaged us through Telegram and were like, hey, is there anything you can do to freeze the tokens? You know, we've just been compromised. And like literally within, you know, minutes of that, all of a sudden, you know, Twitter is getting flooded and everybody's talking about all these assets that are kind of pouring out of the KuCoin hot wallets. And so, prior to that, for the past month or two, we'd really been struggling with, because we're an Ethereum-based token, and there was massive traffic on the Ethereum platform because of the Uniswap decentralized exchange and all these decentralized finance projects that had been, just putting incredible strain on the Ethereum network. And so we'd been kind of struggling for like a month and a half ahead of this because, for us to like transfer out pre-search tokens, for instance, somebody goes and they earn, 1,000 pre-tokens. Current market value of those is like $15. Well, there were days where it was costing like $30 to do a transaction. So it was like, okay, you know, that obviously just doesn't make sense. And so, you know, we had already kind of run into some withdrawal delays, and we were trying to, figure out how to optimize our costs and deal with that. And one of the things that we had realized with our smart contract was that we had some limitations when we built it in 2017. It wasn't going to enable us to take advantage of this batch processing method that would enable us to group all these transactions together and save basically like 55% of gas costs. Oh, wow. So we were already at a point. Yeah, it's crazy.
That's what I call turning a bad situation to a really good one. You're kind of using that opportunity to just revamp the entire protocol.
Totally. We wanted to do a swap anyways. I mean, we were like pretty close as it was, except we have like a pretty tight timeline on our development roadmap. We really, you know, we've been hitting all of our milestones. We brought on a new CTO in July, a guy named Trey Granger. He was the SVP of engineering at Lucidworks, which is the top open source search company in the world. They power search for Reddit and all these big box stores, Walmart and Home Depot and stuff. And it's been amazing. And we ended up, you know, we've been hitting, thanks to our amazing dev team as well, all of our milestones. And we, you know, put out an alpha for our new node platform. And we've committed to the community that we were going to have it ready in Q4. And so we're like, let's see if we can just muddle through this. And then we'll probably do a token swap at the beginning of 2021 after we get that out. And then the hack happened. And due to the way that our token was structured, like we really had no ability to pause anything. But fortunately, we had some other issues with the smart contract that actually prevented it from being listed on Uniswap or some of the decentralized exchanges. And so when the exchanges that Pre is on were able to stop deposits and withdrawals, it basically stopped the hacker from having any way to liquidate the Pre tokens. And so we kind of got into this, you know, spot where it was like, okay, you know, we're a little bit safe for the moment. There's no immediate impact. You know, what are we going to do here? And so we looked at it and we thought, okay, you know what? Time to bite the bullet. We'll do a swap. We'll be able to, you know, correct some of the things in our smart contract. I mean, a lot has changed since 2017. A lot of best practices. We used kind of default contracts from a project called Open Zeppelin, which is kind of the industry standard, which gave us a bunch of other functionality to protect the project moving forward and open up a whole bunch of other different opportunities, you know, with regard to staking.
So it opens up some interesting opportunities with staking, and so we just realized, you know, that this was an opportunity. You know, we didn't have to pay a bunch of fees that we would have had to have paid otherwise. It kind of gave us, you know, a good reason to do it, and so yeah, we ended up implementing this new contract. That just, you know, gives us more flexibility, you know, to prevent things like this in the future. It's obviously, I mean, like the immutability of smart contracts and of decentralized currencies is obviously, you know, one of the big, you know, draws to cryptocurrency, so that, you know, things can't be changed. And so we've tried to basically preserve that as much as possible while still enabling us, you know, let's say somebody gets hacked again. And I mean, like 26 million Pre were stolen. If we did not revert that transaction, it would have, you know, put the project as a whole in just a terrible place for like potentially, you know, months to years, because you'd have all this supply coming onto the market from somebody that does not care about the project and would just be dumping things. And we've actually had issues, you know, similar to that before at a much smaller scale. And it's like super painful, for everybody. And so, you know, we've now got, some different functionality. You know, right now, the way that the project, is set up, I mean, it's still largely centralized. I mean, it's a small team that is building this out. Our next phase, I mean, we're kind of in phase two right now. The next phase is really going to be about governance and, you know, giving the community the full ability to steer the project. And so, you know, we're in this transition period where, you know, we've got, kind of a centralized project to some degree. And so we're basically kind of moving through that phase. And once we get out of that phase in phase three, the new smart contract will enable us to implement some governance protocols that will basically mitigate any of the key, you know, challenges to immutability that the contract currently has. So before it was like, basically it was a dumb contract. It wasn't smart. It really couldn't do anything. And so with the one now, we have got like a global pause feature, for instance. So if somebody like hacked 26 million pre-tokens again, we hit pause and then like nothing can move. And then that gives us the opportunity to basically, you know, fix things. Obviously something that would have to be used, you know, very sparingly. You really
The big red nuclear button.
that's literally how we've built it. It's, you know, it's like
break it's in a glass case.
Exactly.
Colin, yeah. It sounded like just, you know, you guys have you've been around for a long time, and finally there was some type of event that kind of forced you guys to upgrade, but it you were able to take advantage of so many of the technological innovations that have come in smart contracting in the past, you know, 4 years, right, since you guys started. So, you know, it's definitely a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, we really view it that way. And yeah, we're excited about the capabilities that we have now. I mean, it was kind of one of the weak points of the project, truthfully, before. So to be able to start anew and take advantage of the latest, greatest stuff with the knowledge and the insight that we've developed has been just, yeah, huge. And we're in a really strong position now. So yeah, it's definitely exciting.
And kind of in closing, you know, I'm excited about Presearch being able to be now available on all these different DeFi platforms like Uniswap or Balancer and Curve and stuff like that. It seems like it's going to be great for the Presearch kind of ecosystem, market health, liquidity, all that kind of stuff. You're going to have more adoption. And now with that upgraded kind of smart contract, you're going to be able to have really, you know, more funds that are going to be able to look at you guys, to be able to hold you and stuff like that. So really, really impressed with what your team is building. Colin, thank you for coming on to clarify everything about the hack and give us the 101 on Presearch. Everything that we talked about today, we'll have in the show notes as well. So for folks who are listening, who want to find out more about how they could start using Presearch as their homepage for their search engine, for their blockchain explorers, all that kind of stuff, make sure to check out the show notes. We'll have Twitters in there as well. And Colin, we hope you have a great rest of your day there over in Canada. 17,000 awesome. People.
Thanks so much, guys. Great to meet you. Appreciate everything you guys are doing.
Likewise. Take care.
Thanks.